Aunt Ibby in her office, where she looked happily at home amid her impressive collection of the latest gadgets from the world of technology. "Look, Merrily, this is interesting. It says here that one reason we're seeing so many crows in urban areas lately is because of the plentiful food sources we humans provide for them, like parking lots and along roadsides." I hadn't thought about it, but I guess it's true. I mean, the parking lots outside fast food places alone must provide plenty of French fries and breadcrumbs. I frowned. There aren't any fast food places around here, but there are sure lots of birds in the trees on Oliver Street. Winter Street, too. Maybe they're building nesting sites. She sounded doubtful. People all over the city are posting notices and pictures about crows in their neighborhoods that hadn't been there before. There's something unusual going on. Thoughts of the old Alfred Hitchcock movie came to mind, but I didn't say anything about that to my aunt. For over an hour we researched crows, and ravens, and magpies, and grackles. We looked up all the black-feathered members of the family Corvidae we could think of, and came up with quite a few reasons why groups of crows had chosen to congregate in various neighborhoods all over the city, but no explanation of why similar things were not happening in nearby cities. Aunt Ibby contacted bird watchers in Beverly, Danvers, Peabody, Boxford, Gloucester, Marblehead. Nothing out of the ordinary, crow-wise, was apparently going on in any of their communities. In fact, the crow tree phenomenon seemed to begin and end at the Salem city limits. "What did you think of Shannon's feathered friend?" I asked my aunt. Of course, Poe isn't a common American crow, so I guess he's not involved in these strange roostings, nestings, or whatever they're doing. "The Pied Crow. A handsome bird. I like his name," she said. "But how did he know your nickname? Had you met before today?" "Nope, that was kind of creepy. He's going to be ring-bearer at the wedding. I just found out about it. Shannon's father raised Poe practically from an egg, I guess. He's over 20. "Crows are remarkably intelligent. I don't doubt for a minute that Shannon can train him to be a ring-bearer. He's probably known someone with red hair before. Since he's a pet, though, I'm quite sure he isn't part of this murder of crows that suddenly landed in Salem." "What did you call it? A murder of crows?" "Uh-huh. That's the term for a big group of them. Like a flock of sheep. A herd of cows. A murder of crows." Chapter 10. I didn't like the sound of it. A murder of crows? If Aunt Ibby said it was so, it was so. But I still didn't like it. "Why not a flock? A gaggle? A swarm?" I asked. "Why on earth would they call it a murder?" "There are several theories about that," she said. "I don't believe anybody really knows. But Merrily, wouldn't it make a grand title for your investigative report?" Bingo! She was right. I thought of what the station manager had said. Talk about something interesting that the community needs to know about. "Mr. Doan will love it," I said. I'm almost beginning to love it myself. "Let's print out what we found so far, and I'll put together a presentation for him." 2 hours later, it was finished. Pleased with myself, I admired the typewritten pages. Footnoted dissertations on the species, copies of bulletins from the Audubon Society, an article by Roger Torrey Peterson, and a couple of nice, clear photos of the crows in an oak tree next to our garage. They'd all stopped squawking and cawing for a moment, and seemed to be posing for my camera. The black cat with the red collar who'd been hanging around our yard lately was in one of the pictures, sitting on the back fence, making a nice contrast to the birds. Aunt Ibby had provided current Nielsen figures from shows about birds on the Discovery Channel. I put the whole thing in a clear plastic binder titled A Murder of Crows, feeling sure that Mr. Doan would happily agree to my investigation of the Great Salem Crow Invasion. Pete and I hadn't made any plans for the evening. His pal Pee Wee hockey team had an out-of-town tournament going on, so I had plenty of time to grab one of my old college textbooks and do a little studying about my new career move. I grabbed a Pepsi from the refrigerator and sat at the kitchen table with the open book in front of me. The window was partially open, admitting a gentle spring breeze with the faint smell of roses. The raucous cawing from the birds had stopped, at least for the moment, and Orion hopped up onto the windowsill next to me, peering over my shoulder at the printed words. The chapter began with a succinct definition. Investigative journalism is the process of researching and telling a story, usually one that someone else is trying to hide. Trying to hide? I knew there was a story to tell. I knew Aunt Ibby and I were equipped to do careful research. But clearly no one could hide hundreds, probably thousands, of crows. And if anyone knew the reason for this strange bird behavior, why would that person try to hide it? I put the book down, took a sip of soda, and looked out the kitchen window. Orion followed my gaze. There were no cats on the fence. There wouldn't have been room for them. Crows, evenly spaced, sat in a long, silent row along the top of the wooden boards. I looked from the crows to the cat and back. Orion was silent, too. No low growl. No cat comment at all on the sight. After a while, one by one, the crows flew away, some toward Winter Street, some toward Oliver, and, one by one, the visiting cats appeared. The small gray cat was first. I was quite sure she came from Pete's sister Marie's neighborhood. At least that's where I'd first seen her. I thought that Frankie, the white cat, lived somewhere nearby, maybe even next door on Winter Street. I hadn't seen the sleek black lady cat with the red collar for a long time, but she looked well-fed and well-cared for. Maybe she belonged to one of the fine old homes on nearby Washington Square. Orion watched from his vantage point as each of the three girl cats took her position on the fence. He lay quietly sprawled out full length along the sill. I returned to my reading. A good investigative reporter is curious, determined, and possesses a well-developed sense of skepticism. I mentally checked off those attributes, comfortable in believing I had them all, although I'm not quite as skeptical as I once was. A lot has happened in my life recently that has left some of my former beliefs turned upside down. An internship with a local news agency is excellent preparation for this rewarding career. I have the internship part pretty much nailed down, I told Orion, whose eyes were closed and who didn't appear to be listening. Maybe the rewarding career will come along eventually. He moved his ears forward slightly and gave a quick flick of his tail, which might mean, good for you, or, don't bother me, I'm sleeping. Maybe even, who loves you, baby? I skimmed the pages for a few more minutes, touching on the importance of a global outlook, dogged persistence, and appropriate coursework including writing, history, media, and communications. Since I was already more or less gainfully employed teaching some of those subjects, I told myself that I was good to go. Faith, Aunt Ibby had said. Faith. I added faith to my mental list of needed attributes and closed the textbook. I flipped open my laptop and typed in Crows in Salem, figuring that I'd get plenty of responses and lots of pictures and videos. I was right. The messages ranged from funny to frightening, from silly to scholarly. But all of the pictures, all of the videos were definitely creepy, and Alfred Hitchcock and the birds were each mentioned frequently. The scariest video of all, one that had already gone viral, showed a huge cloud of birds flying in a black circle, blotting out the sunlight, around and around, over a small area of the city known as Proctor's Ledge. According to a team of researchers and historians, Proctor's Ledge had been identified as the probable site of the dreadful executions of 1692. Do the crows know? How? I quickly muted the sound. The cawing scream from the crows, that circling murder of crows, had reached an ear-splitting crescendo. Orion, whose ears are surely more sensitive than mine, had made a fast escape through the cat door into the third-floor hall. What must the people who lived near Proctor's Ledge be experiencing? I thought of the crows I'd seen in the trees behind our house, and of the silent row of them who'd perched along the back fence, and breathed a quick prayer that they wouldn't join in that hideous, screeching song. I leaned toward the open window, listening. There was some noise, some distant cackling caws, but nothing like the sounds that had issued from the laptop moments before. I closed the cover slowly, gently, hoping that somehow it would keep the damned birds quiet. Chapter 11. Once again I opened the textbook, but had difficulty concentrating on the words. I'd read over the same sentence about using a compelling lead 3 times when my phone rang. I welcomed the interruption. Caller ID read, River North. Hi, River, I said. What's up? At first I thought perhaps it was a wrong number. She sounded so unlike her usual perky self.
Oh, my God. Have you seen them?
The voice was a shaky whisper.
They're... are thousands of them everywhere.
You mean the crows? Yes, I said. There are pictures all over the internet. Very strange, isn't it?
Thousands, she whispered.
River, are you okay? You don't sound okay. What's wrong? The whisper changed to a strangled-sounding laugh.
Only, what's wrong? I'm what's wrong. Me? It's all my fault. First the dead witches, now this.
You're not making sense. Slow down and tell me what's going on. I took a deep breath and tried to slow down myself. Does it have something to do with the crows?
Something? Everything.
She began to sound more like herself. That was good. Let's talk about it, I said. Would you like me to come and pick you up? It occurred to me that she might not be up to driving. We can go for a ride, and you can tell me what's made you so upset, okay?
Can we go where there aren't any crows, please?
Yes, I said, remembering what Aunt Ibby had told me about the neighboring communities being relatively crow-free. I'll be right over. We'll go to Gloucester, okay?
Okay,
she said, her voice growing stronger.
Thanks, Lee.
You're a good friend. So are you, I told her, meaning it with all my heart. I hope I can help with whatever this is.
So do I. Listen, I'll wait for you out front.
River lives with several friends, all coven members, in an old house on Brown Street. I didn't bother changing clothes, just hurried down the back stairs and out to the garage. There was such urgency in her voice, I knew it was important to get there quickly. There were still plenty of crows in the trees and on the fence, although the crowd seemed to have thinned out quite a bit, and the cawing had quieted significantly. I backed the vet out onto Oliver Street with the windows closed. I didn't want to hear those birds at all. During the short ride to Brown Street, I couldn't help looking at rows of birds on telephone wires. Were they all crows? It didn't seem so. Some of the birds were larger than others. Had the crows mobilized some of the other feathered creatures? I suppressed a shudder as once again the memory of a terrified tippy-hedron flashed in my mind. I parked in front of River's house, easy to identify because of the bright orange front door. River says the color attracts beneficial feng shui. She was, as promised, waiting outside on the small porch, what old New Englanders call a stoop. As soon as she saw me, she ran, long black braid flying, pulled the passenger door open, and slid into the seat.
"Thanks so much for coming, Lee."
She sounded breathless and nervously peered out the window as we pulled away from the curb.
"Let's get out of here. They're everywhere, aren't they?"
"Aunt Ibby says she hasn't heard reports of any unusual activity in Gloucester," I told her, avoiding mentioning that bird watchers in all of the neighboring communities reported the same thing. "We'll head over there, and maybe you can relax a little and tell me why this is bothering you so much. I mean, sure, it's creepy, but I can tell that you're genuinely frightened."
"I am so frightened."
She slid down into the seat, making her tiny frame seem even smaller. I frowned. I wasn't used to thinking of River as frail, but that's how she looked just then. Frail. Fragile. Breakable. "Have you eaten lately?" I was surprised to hear Aunt Ibby's inflection in my own voice. "What you need is a good meal." She blinked, then gave a wan smile.
"You sound just like your aunt. And you're right. I guess I forgot to eat today."
The wide eyes filled with tears.
"I've been too scared. I don't know how I'm going to get through tonight's tarot time show."
"Okay." I headed for Route 128. "You can tell me all about it. I know where there's a great vegetarian restaurant in Gloucester. When we get there, we'll talk. You'll eat. Everything's going to be all right. The show will be fine. You'll see." I spoke with more confidence than I felt, but my friend seemed to brighten just a little bit. I tried for a change of subject. "And it looks like we'll be working for the same boss pretty soon. I have a proposal already for Mr. Doan, and I'm pretty sure he's going to like it."
"That's great. What's it about?"
"Oops, this isn't a good time to speak of crows. River is already scared to death." I'm going to wait until he sees the idea before I talk about it. Haven't even told Pete."
"I understand. Could be bad luck to say anything until you're sure."
She smiled again, this time a real one.
"But he'll love it. I'm sure. You're so smart."
A little giggle.
"Besides, he's getting you free."
"True, that always makes points with Mr. Doan." We sped along 128, noticing how the temperature dropped a few degrees when we reached Beverly, like it always does. I've never figured out why. Maybe Wanda the Weather Girl knows. I made a mental note to ask her when I got back to WICH-TV. "It's going to be kind of fun being back at the station," I said. "I like teaching, but I've really missed the friends I made there."
"They miss you, too," River said. "Marty and Rhonda talk about you all the time."
I nodded, thinking about Marty, the camera woman on my canceled Nightshades show, and Rhonda, the way smarter than she looks, station receptionist. "We had some fun," I said, "and a few, adventures."
"So I've heard."
She seemed to relax a bit.
"And I am hungry. I'm glad I called you."
She turned in her seat, facing the open window beside her.
"Look, lots of trees and no crows."
She was right. I saw a few birds darting in and out of the wayside foliage, but none of the large black variety we'd seen in such numbers in Salem. Aunt Ibby had been right about that, and I was glad she'd been. But all the same, it was creepy. Why were the crows converging on one city and staying away from the surrounding areas? I shook the bad thought away, hoping River wouldn't pick up on my doubts, my negativity. She's intuitive that way, maybe because she's a witch, or maybe because she reads the tarot. Time for another subject change. We rounded the rotary in Gloucester, heading for Holly Street and the good old Willow Rest restaurant. I could almost taste the blueberry pancakes. We passed Cherry Street, and I pointed to the Dogtown Commons sign on the corner. "Ever been to Dogtown?" I asked, not waiting for an answer. When I was a kid, I used to go horseback riding in there. It's full of trails and old dirt roads. Fun, but really easy to get confused and lost.
I've never been, River said, looking back at the red sign. Megan told me about it, though. She said witches used to live there a long time ago.
Widows, I said. Widows of seamen and soldiers who didn't come back from the War of 1812. They kept dogs for protection and for company, I suppose. I guess old women living alone in ramshackle houses off in the woods with a bunch of mean dogs might get called witches. I shrugged. At least they didn't kill them like they did in Salem.
Tammy Younger.
River spoke in a positive tone.
Megan said Tammy Younger lived in Dogtown. She was queen of the witches there. Used to put a curse on any team of oxen carrying fish from the harbor, unless the driver paid her a toll to cross a little bridge near her house.
Poor old lady, I said.
No, she really was a witch.
River smiled.
Megan said so.
I wasn't about to argue the qualifications of a long-dead witch with a current one, so didn't comment further on the status of Tammy Younger. I pulled into one of the parking spaces in front of the restaurant. It's not a big place, and there were already quite a few cars and several trucks there ahead of us. We hurried inside, and were lucky to find a table for two near the fresh food market section. I'd already decided on the blueberry pancakes. It was well past breakfast time, but who cares? River perused the menu, exclaiming in delight over the many vegetarian options, and decided on a field greens salad with dried cranberries, apples, candied walnuts, and onions.
First time in Gloucester? Asked the waitress as she delivered our food. Her name tag read Dolores.
Nope, I said. Just a little day trip from Salem. My friend is a vegetarian, and I remembered that this place is famous for it.
Salem, huh?
She looked around the room and lowered her voice. What's up with all the crows over there? My son goes to the college, and he texted me about it. Sent pictures, too. Wanna see? She reached into her apron pocket. I held up my hand. No, that's okay. We've seen them in person.
Thanks a lot, Dolores. We came here to get away from the damned birds.
I watched River's face. The fear was back in her eyes. Things got worse. Our waitress was in a mood to chat.
It's got people around here talking about the Dogtown witches, especially Peg Wesson.
I frowned, shook my head, rolled my eyes, everything I could think of to get her to stop talking about witches, to go away. It didn't work. She was just warming up to her subject.
Yep, old Peg. Guess you've heard about her and the silver button, huh?
Thanks anyway, I said. I know you're busy. We'll just eat this lovely food and be on our way. River had put down her fork, eyes wide.
What about her? I'd like to hear the story, if you have time.
Unfortunately, Dolores had time. She glanced around the room. No one even made eye contact with her, and no new customers waited at the cash register. I thought for a moment she might pull up a chair and sit down with us.
Well, she said, her tone conspiratorial, the story is that Peg Wesson used to fly around on a broomstick. One time, she flew over a soldier's camp in the form of a big bird. A soldier took a silver button off his sleeve, loaded his musket with it, and shot the bird.
Dolores leaned toward us, whispering,
At that very moment, back in Gloucester, Peg Wesson fell to the ground with a broken leg. When a doctor examined her, out popped a silver button.
She raised her right hand. True story. I faked a laugh. River's face had gone pale.
What kind of bird was it?
Oh my gosh, didn't I tell you? It was a crow. A big old black crow.
Chapter 12. I almost put my head right down on my blueberry pancakes and cried. The one topic I'd brought my friend here to escape had caught up with us already. Actually, River took it better than I expected. Still pale, and with the hand holding her fork shaking, She looked down at her salad and kept right on eating. When neither of us responded to the story, Dolores mumbled, "Well, have a nice day," and, mercifully, left us.
"I'm sorry, River," I said. "I knew this place was close to Dogtown, and now I remember hearing the Silver Button story when I was a kid, but it didn't occur to me that..."
She looked up. "It's okay, really. I can't run away from what's happening. I guess nobody in Salem can. The crows, I mean, and the dead witches."
"You think there's some kind of connection between the crows and the three deaths?"
"Oh, yes. Of course there is. And somebody's got to pay the toll."
"The toll?" I put both hands to my temples. "Wait a minute. What toll? What are you talking about?"
"Tammy Younger."
She looked at me as though I wasn't quite bright.
"It's just like the fisherman. If he didn't pay Tammy what she wanted before he drove across her bridge, she'd curse his whole team of oxen. So he was just stuck there with his fish until he paid. Now somebody's got to pay the toll so the crows can leave and the witches can stop dying."
She scooped the last few sugared walnuts from her bowl.
"Are you going to eat that last pancake? I didn't realize how hungry I was."
I was glad to see her eating, and pleased that she'd come to some sort of a satisfying conclusion about the crows and the recent deaths, even though nothing she'd just said made the least bit of sense. I slid my plate over to her side of the table. "So Tammy collected money whenever someone wanted to use that bridge?"
"Not always money," River said, pouring maple syrup onto the pancake. "It could be fish, a basket of clams, his hat, whatever the fisherman had that the witch wanted. That's how it works. I get it."
She sounded like herself again, and her smile was genuine. "I'm glad she gets it. I sure don't."
"Shall we order dessert?" I asked. "The pastries are homemade." "Peanut butter cookies and coffee?"
"Sounds good to me."
After dessert, we left the cozy restaurant with River obviously in a much happier state of mind. I was pleased about that, but totally confused as to exactly why it was. I took the long way home, driving along old Route 127, delaying as long as I could the return to crow-infested Salem. The light was beginning to fade, and I hoped maybe the birds would all be asleep by the time we got to River's place. There were still a few of the big black birds on the telephone wires when we got there, but at least they were quiet. "Will you have time for a quick nap before you have to get ready for your show?" I'd worked the same schedule when Nightshades was the station's late movie program, and I knew how much time it took to get costumed, made up, and prepared to comment on the night's scary film. "Thanks, Lee. Don't want a nap. I'm fine. I have some planning to do, and I need to have a talk with my roommates about a few things. Plans for Megan's funeral are coming along great. No worries. Love you."
Still smiling, she climbed out of the vet and, braid bouncing, ran across the sidewalk, up the stairs, across the stoop, and disappeared through the orange door into the house. Still wondering how and why my friend's gloomy mood and tearful pronouncements had somehow turned into a positive attitude and sunny smiles, when all I'd done was feed her a late lunch and a couple of cookies, I headed home. I put the car into the garage, all the while looking over my shoulder at the treetops. I knew the crows were still there, silent now, but were they watching me? I hurried through the yard. Orion met me on the back steps. While I fumbled for my key, he washed his face and groomed his whiskers, seemingly unconcerned, or at least disinterested, in the murder of crows lurking in trees all over Salem. Opening the door, I waited for the cat to go in first, while I glanced around the yard. In the gathering dusk, the back fence was silhouetted against nightshine from the streetlights on Winter Street. No birds perched,
but one cat, motionless, faced in our direction. I couldn't tell at first which one of Orion's friends it might be, but then I caught the glint of a silver buckle on a red collar. Some people think black cats are bad luck, but I remembered when a black cat who looked a lot like this one had helped get me out of some serious trouble. I gave her a little salute and went inside. I clicked on the hall light and started up the stairs to my apartment. Orion was already comfortably sprawled on the couch when I entered. "Guess it's just you and me tonight, boy," I told him. "Aunt Ibby has a meeting of her book club, and Pete's at a hockey tournament." It was still early, but donning PJs and fixing a bowl of microwave popcorn seemed like a good idea. "I'll be back in a minute," I promised the cat. It took a little more than a minute, but pajamaed, slippered, and carrying a bowl of fresh, hot, and liberally buttered popcorn, I returned to the living room. Orion had moved from the couch and now sat facing my mission-style barrister's bookcase. Behind its glass panels were housed my college textbooks, the set of World Book Encyclopedias Aunt Ibby had given me in first grade, a set of Sue Grafton mysteries from A to Y, and my collection of miniature bronze pencil sharpeners. They used to be lined up on top of the bookcase, but the cat had developed a habit of knocking certain ones onto the floor, so I'd moved them onto the inside shelves. Now he sat, hunched forward, clearly intent on something. A spider, maybe? I put the bowl down on the coffee table, picked up a TV guide, and rolled it up, ready to smack any intruding bug. Scooching down to the cat's level, I peered into the glass. There was nothing crawling or scampering in there. Deciding that our vain cat was just watching his own reflection, I'd started to stand up when I caught the tiniest flicker of light, then the swirling colors. I sat on the floor beside Orion and watched as the picture began to form. No gazebo this time. No beach. I leaned closer to the glass. I was in somebody's yard. There was a lawn and a small garden. Purple petunias and pink impatiens surrounded a white birdbath. In the center of the picture was a tree. I reached for the cat, patting soft fur gently. "What kind of tree is that?" I whispered. As sometimes happens with these things, the tree came into clearer focus. "Apples," I said, recognizing it at once. "It's an apple tree." As visions go, this wasn't a bad one. It didn't make any sense, of course, didn't mean anything to me, but at least there was nobody dead in it. I sat there on the floor with my cat, just watching. For a long moment, the scene remained steady. Nothing moved, nothing changed. Then there was a dark blur of motion. A bird flew from the tree, down into the birdbath, splashing water onto the flowers. The bird was very large, very black. The crow returned to the tree, where it was joined by another, and another. Before long, the tree was full of them. I could tell by their open beaks that they were cawing and cackling, and I was glad the picture had no sound. As Orion and I watched from my living room floor, the birds rose into the air at once. They formed a tight, whirling black circle above the apple tree, then flew away. The tree's branches had been stripped bare. For a moment, Orion and I looked at one another, cat nose to human nose, then back at the bookcase, which by then was just a bookcase. No crows, no bare-branched tree, just rows of books and pencil sharpeners behind hinged glass panels. "Did you see that?" Orion hopped back up onto the couch and reached a tentative paw toward the popcorn bowl. "I know you're just pretending to be an ordinary cat," I muttered,
moving the bowl out of his reach, taking a handful of the buttery stuff and plopping down beside him.
Never mind. We'll watch TV, he said, gazing toward the blank and silent television screen.
I opened the slightly curled pages of the TV schedule.
Okay. Deadliest Catch or Wicked Tuna?
Orion likes anything about fishing.
Tammy Younger liked fish, too. I turned on the set and tried to focus on raging ocean waves and careening crab traps, hoping to erase lingering images of death in a gazebo and a gathering murder of crows.
Chapter 13. I'm afraid I dozed off and missed the end of an argument between Sig and Captain Keith. I'd have to wait a week to catch up with the adventures of the crews of the Wizard and the Northwestern and the rest. I yawned, turned off the TV, and with Orion tagging along behind me, padded down the hall to the kitchen. I poured a saucer of milk for the cat and a glass of 2% for myself. The Kit Kat clock showed 11 o'clock. "Come on, Cat," I said. "We'll watch the late news in bed, and maybe stay awake long enough to see Rivers' show, too." I climbed into bed, piled up a few pillows, leaned back, and turned on the TV. New anchor Buck Covington came into view. Orion gave one snooty cat sniff and headed for the kitchen windowsill, one of his favorite spots for snoozing. The smiling Covington delivered local news of City Hall happenings and gave a report on a Girl Scout who'd sold 500 boxes of cookies. His facial expression changed to one of appropriate concern when a startling video of the mass of crows over Preston's ledge filled the screen.
"Senior members of the Massachusetts Audubon Society have gathered in Salem," he intoned, "to conduct a study on the recent, somewhat uncharacteristic behavior of several varieties of American crows in this area. Wildlife biologists from the United States Department of Agriculture have also arrived in Salem and will discuss methods of dispersing the crows without harming them."
Close-up of a crow.
"According to ornithological experts..."
Covington didn't even stumble over the word. Doan was right. He was good with a teleprompter.
"The crow has great intelligence. It is adaptable to its environment. Crows will eat almost anything, and part of their ability to survive is their being omnivorous."
Wow. Ornithological and omnivorous in one paragraph without even blinking.
"They eat whatever is available,"
he continued, his expression sincere.
"A North Salem viewer has reported that hundreds of them had roosted on a backyard fruit tree, and by morning had completely stripped it of both budding fruit and leaves."
The smile was back, and the reporter moved on to some political news from the Boston State House, then introduced a Salem ward councillor who led a crowd opposed to a hike in property taxes. I wasn't surprised when I recognized Victor Protector among the protesters.
"Never met a protest he didn't like," Pete had said.
Covington signed off wishing all a good night, along with a reminder to stay tuned for Tarot Time with River North. So, the denuded apple tree in the bookcase vision had a basis in reality. In a strange way, that was a relief. Most of my damned visions don't make any sense at all, like the gazebo and the man with dead eyes. "River's on next, Orion," I called. I could see the cat on the kitchen windowsill reflected in the tilted mirror at the foot of the bed. "Come on, the news is over." He appeared in the doorway immediately, leaped up onto the bed, and positioned himself on a pillow next to my head, facing the screen as River's intro music played. An old black-and-white photo of the bandstand on Salem Common served as a background for rolling titles. The bandstand is shaped a little like a gazebo, with a domed roof and open sides. Is that important?
A commercial for a new Amish ice cream stand at the Salem Willows Park was next. Then River appeared, seated in her high-backed rattan chair. If the events of the day had been upsetting to her, it didn't show. Not one bit. Tonight, the mass of dark hair was piled on top of her head, with a few strategically placed wisps framing her face. She wore a long-sleeved black velvet dress I recognized as vintage 1950s. The low-scooped neckline was accented by a bright red Victoria's Secret bustier. River has a gift for mixing and matching styles and periods. This was one of her best combinations. She looked absolutely gorgeous. She began the show with a brief announcement about the time for Megan's memorial service at Town Hall, including the fact that the Wiccan community would hold a private service for their beloved friend at a later date. Tarot Time always features live card readings for viewers who call in before, midway through, and after the night's feature movie. This time, though, she surprised me, and I'm sure all of her regular viewers, with the announcement that she'd be doing her first reading of the evening for the city of Salem. Is it because of the crows? The answer came immediately. We are all concerned about the mysterious appearance of thousands of crows over Salem, River said. Perhaps the tarot can give us some answers about why these wise and ancient winged friends have chosen to visit us. Winged friends? Try telling that to all the people cleaning crow poop off their cars. Astrologists tell us that Salem's birth date is September 16th, 1626, at 11:15 a.m., she said, with a pretty wink and a dimpled smile. I'm not an astrologist, and I'm not sure how they arrived at that date. Perhaps Salem's founder, Roger Conant's writings, let them figure it out. I've learned, though, that through using astrology it is possible for the cards to provide information for a city, a county, a country, a company. She placed a card face up on the table, and the camera zoomed in on a colorful picture of a woman in a vineyard. On the woman's gloved hand was a black bird. The Nine of Pentacles will serve as what we call the significator, River announced. And I've asked someone new to the city to shuffle the deck for us. Please meet our new WICH-TV friend, Buck Covington.
That was a surprise. Covington had removed the obligatory tie and jacket of a newscaster. A fitted white shirt, collar unbuttoned with sleeves rolled up, indicated that Mr. Doane's new hire's body was every bit as attractive as his face. He leaned across the table and picked up the deck of cards. She leaned toward him. I wondered if everyone watching was as aware of the look that passed between them as I was. Yep, something's happening there. Without taking his eyes off River, Buck Covington dutifully shuffled, even adding a Vegas-like fanning move, and replaced the deck face down.
Okay.
Perfect, she said. Thank you, Buck. It seemed that was his cue to leave the set, but he didn't take the hint. Just sat there staring at River. Well, then, she said, it's customary to ask a question at this point, and the one that seems to be on all of our minds is, what are the crows doing in Salem, and how do we send them away? Next came a close-up of River and the table. If Buck was still on the set, he wasn't on camera.
Dumb as a brick, Mr. Doane had said. Maybe he was right.
River began to lay cards face up in a pattern around the Nine of Pentacles. It was a different pattern than the one she usually used. This time she chose 12 cards from the shuffled deck and arranged them in a diamond shape. The 12 cards relate to the signs of the zodiac, River announced. We'll begin with Aries. Judgment is the card that fell here. This means it will take diplomacy to handle situations at home. She put a hand, palm out, next to her lips in a mock whisper.
Mr. Covington told us that the city officials and the United States government are both working on our crow problem, so diplomacy is a good idea.
She moved to the next card.
The Nine of Cups is in Taurus. Financial affairs are indicated here.
She nodded.
The problem may get to be expensive for the city.
Next came the Eight of Wands.
Gemini tells us here that communications make progress toward the goal. Good.
I wondered if everyone in the audience was as confused as I was. Exactly how would diplomacy, money, and communication solve the problem of a gazillion crows pooping all over the city and stripping fruit trees? River proceeded to read the cards positioned at Cancer and Leo. The star reversed at the Cancer position told her that crows are stubborn, and the moon card at Leo reversed told her that the problem in question would take imagination along with a practical approach.
That makes sense.
Virgo was next, and River held up an ominous-looking card, the Devil. River gave a delicate lift of one velvet-clad shoulder.
This is an odd one. It indicates the need for balanced meals and plenty of rest. Oh, well, as Buck told us earlier, crows will eat anything.
Libra, it turns out, is the house of marriage, lawsuits, and open enemies. The card face up showed a knight in black armor, the Knight of Pentacles.
This handsome knight is the lord of the wild and fertile land, River said. He's a methodical man. Trustworthy but unimaginative. He loves nature and is kind to animals.
She tapped the card with a slender finger.
Maybe this man has the answer to our crow problem. We'll see.
Marriage? Methodical, handsome, trustworthy, unimaginative man? Was she seeing Buck Covington in her own future? The thought made me smile. Scorpio showed the Knight of Swords.
I knew that card.
It was the one River had always chosen to represent Pete in my readings.
He's the Knight of the Spirits of the Air, River said. Perhaps this card brings the involvement of police.
I'm pretty sure she threw that idea in because of Pete. I knew it was almost time for the break leading to the movie. Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius were covered in fast succession. River wound up the reading with Pisces, the sign for secret enemies and secret desires. The card displayed was the Lovers. I thought of Shannon and Dakota and remembered that I had to go maid of honor dress shopping in the morning. Shall we go to sleep now, Orion? I have a busy day planned.
Mwah,
he said, golden eyes still focused on the screen. What? You want to watch the scary movie? Okay, let's see what it is. Of course it was the birds. Forget about it, I said, clicking off the picture even before the title had finished rolling.
Mwah,
he repeated, and stalked off toward the kitchen window. Chapter 14. I'd arranged to meet Shannon, Therese, and the two bridesmaids at 9:30 in the morning at Dunkin' Donuts on Newberry Street in Peabody, just a few blocks down from the bridal shop. I awoke early, showered, and dressed in jeans and a blue chambray shirt, being sure to wear a strapless bra in anticipation of the current trend in bridal wear. I clicked on the kitchen TV while I sipped orange juice and fed Orion. Scott Palmer appeared on screen. "They call it a murder of crows, ladies and gentlemen," he said. "That's the correct term for the astounding number of the birds who've been roosting here in Salem during the past 2 days and nights. Audubon officials estimate that the birds gathered in the city number somewhere between 30,000 and 40,000. City officials are in consultation with wildlife biologists from the USDA. Sources have told WICH-TV that pyrotechnics may be used to safely clear the various roosting spots. Similar to 4th of July fireworks, the devices look and sound like bottle rockets. Hopefully, this will cause the crows to disperse into smaller groups and spread out over a broader area. The now-familiar video of the birds over Proctor's Ledge aired again, and Scott continued with the voiceover.
At an emergency meeting yesterday, members of the City Council discussed the possible health risk involved due to the high concentration of excrement caused by these birds. Oddly enough, though, despite the extraordinary number of crows in this video, a little damage of that type has been noted at the Proctor's Ledge site. Residents are asked to assist the dispersal project by calling the number at the bottom of your screen to report the locations of large groups of crows.
"What do you think about that, Cat?" I asked. "Why would the darn birds poop on everything else in Salem but keep the place where the witches were hanged clean?"
Orion kept right on eating his kibble, but I saw his ears move forward the way they do when he's listening.
"I'm going to add some information about the pyrotechnics to my proposal for Mr. Doan. I hope they do it. That would make for some good video. Everybody likes fireworks."
He looked up, golden eyes unblinking. "Except crows," I said, "and maybe cats. Well, I've got to get going. Maid of Honor dress shopping today." I put my glass in the sink and picked up my purse. "I hope Shannon isn't thinking along the lines of pastels and ruffles." Together we walked down two flights of stairs. Orion darted through the cat entrance to Aunt Ibby's kitchen, and I left the house via the back door, wondering if maybe we should consider painting it orange. The yard was quiet. I hardly dared to look toward the trees, but of course I had to. Among the leaves there were only a few birds visible. Most of them must have left the roost and flown somewhere else. What do crows do during the day, anyway? Look for food, I supposed. Wherever they'd gone, I was pretty sure it was somewhere in Salem. I backed the vet out of the garage, glad both of our cars were safely sheltered during most of the crows' roosting periods. At least the car washes in town are benefiting from all this, I thought. It would probably be a good idea to pitch some of them a few ideas for commercials. I'd be sure to suggest it to Mr. Doan. I smiled when I realized that I was back to thinking like a WICHTV employee. Hilda Mendez's Jeep and Teresa's Mazda Miata were already in the parking lot in front of the familiar pink and brown Dunkin' Donuts shop when I arrived. Hilda waved to me from a booth next to a window. Shannon, Therese, and a young woman I presumed to be Maureen were seated at the table. I hurried inside and joined them. "Hi. I'm not late, am I?"
"No, you're right on time. Therese hasn't started taking pictures yet."
Shannon slid out of the booth and hugged me.
"We just got here. Haven't even bought our coffee yet. We stopped at a car wash and had to wait in line."
She made a face.
"Doggone birds. Anyway, this is my cousin Maureen, all the way from Florida for the wedding."
I stuck out my hand. "Glad to meet you, Maureen," I said. "Shannon talks about you all the time."
"Talks about all the trouble we used to get into when we were kids, I'll bet."
Shannon's cousin was a petite blonde with blue eyes. Without a speck of makeup, she had a complexion so smooth, so flawless, so perfect, it probably glowed in the dark. Her handshake was firm.
"I was just telling everybody about the time we took her dad's riding lawnmower and crashed it right into the summer house."
"You had a special house for summer?" Therese asked.
"No, not a real house," Shannon explained. "It has open sides. My dad calls it the pergola."
I'm sure I gasped out loud. I'd heard Aunt Ibby use the term pergola before. "A gazebo," I said. "A pergola is the same thing as a gazebo, right?"
"Guess so,"
Shannon nodded.
"Are you guys going to have a donut? I am. Probably the last one before the wedding. I think I want one of those skinny mermaid gowns. White, of course."
Therese had moved a short distance away and was quietly filming the four of us.
"I'll pass on the donuts," she said. "When we were in the bakery, I got frosting on my lens. I love frosting."
Hilda pointed to a chocolate-frosted donut with colored sprinkles.
"I'll have one of those." "What about the bridesmaid dresses? Do you think we should have mermaid dresses too, Shannon?"
If you like them, Shannon said. But you don't have to. I don't want you to get something you hate. I'd love it if it was something you'd like to wear again.
Hilda groaned. I know what you mean. I've given at least 3 bridesmaid dresses to Goodwill. Are you going to have a donut, Lee?
I was still thinking about that gazebo.
Huh? Oh, sure, I said. I like the cinnamon ones.
That's my favorite, too.
Maureen stepped up to the counter, and the rest of us fell into line behind her.
Have you picked a color yet, Shannon? I hope it's not pink. The last wedding I was in, the bride had pink for everything, even the invitations and the cake. Pink just washes me out.
Definitely not pink, Shannon declared as we carried our coffee cups and donuts to the booth. I do have an idea for the color scheme, though. It's a surprise. I hope you'll all like it.
What's it going to be? Hilda smiled. Blue, I'll bet, to match Dakota's pretty eyes.
Not blue, Shannon said, though he does have fabulous blue eyes.
I'm glad you're still planning on a beach wedding, Shannon. I tried to get the vision of the gazebo out of my mind. We'll probably have to reserve a shelter. Any idea which beach you'd like?
Oh, didn't I tell you, Lee? There's a pretty little beach right behind Daddy's house in Marblehead. I don't know why I didn't think of it in the first place. And we're picking June 21st for the date because it's the longest day of summer, the day with the most sunshine. Dakota picked it. He says it's the beginning of a life filled with sunshine for us. It'll be a morning wedding. Then in the afternoon we catch the cruise ship for the Virgin Islands. Honeymoon, here we come.
It's perfect. So romantic.
Maureen licked cinnamon sugar from her fingers.
And we can even use the summer house.
Perfect, Shannon said.
The gazebo. Oh, yes. Perfect.
Hilda looked up at the donut-shaped clock on the wall.
Almost time for our appointment. Shall we head for the bridal shop?
She was right. We finished our coffees, and we each ate every crumb of our donuts. I followed Hilda's jeep down Newberry Street and pulled up in front of the shop window, where faceless black lacquered mannequins poised in white dresses, ball gowns and sheaths, trains and ruffles, long and short, strapless and sleeved. There was something here for every bride, and hopefully something not pink for every bridesmaid and maid of honor. We were greeted enthusiastically at the door and escorted to a long plush couch, where our bridal consultant introduced herself as Corina, and Shannon introduced the 3 of us. Teresa's camera focused on the group while Corina asked Shannon to describe the groom, the venue, the date, the kind of gown she liked, along with the price range she had in mind. Other than the woman's audible gasp when she heard the weeks-away wedding date, the ambiance was so much like the bridal gown shopping television shows, I felt as though there might be a couple of studio cameras there in addition to Teresa's handheld Panasonic. Corina smiled and nodded throughout Shannon's answers to her questions, but she wasn't able to disguise amazement when Shannon told her about Poe's part in the festivities.
Oh my goodness, a crow? A live crow ring bearer? How original.
He's a pid crow, Shannon explained. He's black and white.
She extended both arms, indicating the rest of us sitting with her on the couch.
Here's my surprise. I'm going to have a black and white wedding. I want my attendants in black, me in white.
She clapped her hands together.
It'll be fabulous.
It was a revelation to me. I rarely wear black. I have the obligatory little black dress, but that's about it.
I looked at the faces of my fellow bridal attendants and saw surprise mirrored there, too. Corina's smile grew broader and, I thought, more sincere.
I love it, she said. I've done several black and white weddings before and they were all fabulous, but none of them had a crow.
It was Lee's idea that inspired me,
Shannon said, pointing at me.
My idea?
Sure. The chocolate and white cake? Black and white?
I saw a black and white wedding once on TV,
Maureen offered,
and all the guests wore black and white, too.
That would look amazing in the pictures. Hilda said, what do you think, Therese?
I love it.
How about you, Shannon?
Awesome idea. We haven't ordered invitations yet, so we can easily include that. Something like, the bride and groom request that guests wear black or white.